we start off this afternoon by talking history. And to do that, well, we turn to the absolute best in the business, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her book, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, now available as an e-book. And it's a pleasure to welcome Doris back to downtown. Doris, good afternoon.
Hello, I'm with you again. Absolutely.
Well, today would have been the 107th birthday of Lyndon Johnson, a man you knew so very well. It's a different political time than when Lyndon Johnson came into power. How do you think he would fare in this day and age?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, as I was thinking that it was his 107th birthday would have been, and that I knew him when I was young, I don't know whether that means I'm really old or I was really young. It just seems so long ago. But anyway, the interesting thing is, you know, in some ways he would have fared very well in the tech world of today, because even when he was in the 1960s, he was like a teenager. I mean, he had phones everywhere in, you know, in the bathroom, on the rafts, in his pool. He had tickers in his office. He had, for the AP and the UP, he had three televisions going at any one time. He was obsessed with having breaking news up to the moment. So that part of the political culture, I think, he'd be very much at home with. He would have things in his ears, things everywhere to be able to listen to what was going on. However, given his way of talking, as we know from the presidential tapes, you know, there tended to be colorfulness and sometimes crudeness and sometimes things that might have come out spontaneously in today's world that might have given him trouble. But it would have made him seem a lot more interesting than he did seem, because he still is the most larger-than-life figure I've ever known. And if we'd seen that real him, as we might have in today's world, we might have hated him, but we would have found him most fascinating.
Well, you knew him very well. He brought you into his inner circle as a young woman, told you that you reminded him of his mother. He was such a force of nature. How did you keep from being overwhelmed by this presence?
You know, I think about it now, looking back. If I had had the access to him now that I had then, I probably would have been a lot more unspontaneous about it, because I would have been thinking, oh, what question should I ask him? And this is my big moment in history, and I'll never have this chance again. But when you're in your 20s, you're just not thinking that way. So somehow he's just, I mean, it sounds crazy to say, but he's this guy. And, you know, and there were times when he'd want me to stay and work for him and just talk to him at the end of the day. And maybe I had some boyfriend that I wanted to go to the movies with, and I feel, oh, no, I've got to see him again. And I think about that now, I could kill myself. I mean, why not spend every minute you can to learn, and especially because I became an historian. But I didn't know that then. I just knew that I was young and I was lucky enough to be in the White House. And I, you know, I just took it more at ease than I think I would if I had him today.
Well, and you also had to change some of your patterns as a young person, too, and get up extra early in the morning so you could be prepared for morning visits from him when he didn't sleep well at night.
That's right. When I went to the ranch, during those last, you know, years of his life on the on the ranch, there was a sadness about him because he knew that his legacy had been cut in two because of the war in Vietnam. And, you know, I think I wish so much that he were alive today to see that at least with the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, that his domestic accomplishments and his incredible ability to deal with Congress is finally being recognized. But in those days, because he was sad, he couldn't sleep well. And he didn't want to wake Lady Bird sometimes, or sometimes she'd be away. So he would just come into my room to talk to me. And there was a kind of loneliness, I think, in him. He just needed people around him at every moment. Even when he took a nap, he wanted me to be outside his room just waiting there so that the moment he waked up, there'd be somebody there. I think that's partly why he had the tickers and the telephones and the televisions going at all time. Solitude was the last thing he ever wanted.
We're talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin on Downtown, the author of Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. What was it about this Southerner, this man of Texas, that made him such a proponent of landmark civil rights legislation?
You know, I think what happened is when he was young, when he was in college, he taught at a small school in Texas, in Cotulla, Texas, and there were Mexican-American kids in that school who were not only poor, but were the victims of prejudice. And he said, he said this when he gave the Great We Shall Overcome speech, that when he looked in their eyes, he could see that their entire life was going to be stunted by the discrimination and the prejudice. And he cared about poverty, I think, from the time he was young. But then as a senator from Texas, I mean, he did one thing. There was a Civil Rights Act of 1957 that he shepherded through, but it was pretty moderate. But once he became president, and made that huge decision as soon as JFK died to go for the Civil Rights Bill in 1964, which is the subject of the great play All the Way, which is going to be a movie, HBO, with Bryan Cranston playing LBJ, which I've seen, and I think it's going to be extraordinary because I saw the play about five times. Once he made that decision and he got that Civil Rights Act through that desegregated the South, I think there was such a feeling of fulfillment, knowing that he had done something that would stand the test of time, that then he wanted to go for voting rights, and then he wanted to go for fair housing. And it really became a part of him. I have no doubt about that.
Is there some sort of cruel irony in the fact that in many ways, when it came to civil rights, he was far ahead of John F. Kennedy, and yet some of those measures are seen as an extension of the JFK legacy and not Johnson's ideas?
No, I think that's fair that there is something cruel and ironic about it, because there's no doubt that finally JFK did come out for the Civil Rights Act, which became the law of 64, but he was slow and reluctant to come to it. I remember I was part of that march on Washington, that the Martin Luther King, Gary B. I Have a Dream speech in 63 in August. I was a young girl at that time, and I remember we wished that JFK would be there, and he wasn't there, of course. But he did finally come out for that bill. But I don't know whether he would have been able to get it passed the way LBJ did. There's no question that he didn't have, nor could anyone have had, that relationship with the Congress, because Congress was LBJ's home. And his ability to get Everett Dirksen to come with me on the Republican minority leader, you know, just blatant pressure, force, charm. You know, Everett, you come with me on this bill, and 200 years from now, 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. How could Dirksen resist? I think maybe eventually if JFK had run in 64 and won that big election, maybe he could have gotten it through too, but I doubt it would have gotten through in 64 without LBJ.
You mentioned All the Way, a wonderful play. I had a chance to see it in your old stomping grounds of Cambridge at American Repertory Theater. That portrayed Lyndon Johnson in a very favorable light with that incredible work of convincing and arm-twisting of people. The movie Selma didn't quite do the same thing, and you've been very critical about the way Johnson was portrayed in that bit of a fictionalized history.
Yes, I really think that, you know, it wasn't fair. I mean, it's one thing to take some liberties, as movies inevitably do, because you're creating a world of imagination where we don't have actual fact when people are having conversations. But it's not fair to portray somebody really wrongly when the right information is out there. And no one would have argued that LBJ was not for voting rights. I mean, he even came out for it in his State of the Union before the Selma demonstration. There are, you know, taped conversations of him talking to Martin Luther King about, you know, we need you to get out there and push us from the outside in. And it was a great partnership between the two of them. It's one of those moments in history when the civil rights movement as the outside force pushes the inside people to do what should be done. It was a great American moment, and that movie could have been fabulous at a time like this with racial problems, to show that here was a moment when whites and blacks worked together, the president and the outside movement worked together, and instead somehow it made LBJ into almost the reluctant villain of the movie. And I'm not sure why they did it. It just didn't make any sense to have it done that way, when the better story, the more dramatic story, was the truth.
Doris, one of the things I'm going to miss most about the ending of Jon Stewart's reign on The Daily Show were your appearances. You told a wonderful story the last time you were on about a friend of Richard Nixon's who was talking with Lyndon Johnson, and the advice that was passed from Johnson back to Nixon. Can you share that story?
Oh, yeah. What happened is, many years later, I met a man who was actually had been the CEO of Pepsi-Cola, and he was a good friend of Richard Nixon's. And he said to me, "Now, I know you knew LBJ when you were a young girl, but I have an LBJ story I bet you don't know." And he told me that when Nixon first got into the presidency, he had some sensitive matter that he wanted this man, Don Kendall, to talk to Lyndon Johnson about. So the man went down to the ranch. He said, "I get to the ranch. Johnson is working on his memoirs," and he looks up grumpily, and he said, "How am I supposed to remember everything that happened 20 years ago, 10 years ago? These chapters are just not coming alive at all. The only ones that are any good at all are where I had this taping system, and I used to press a button when I had an important telephone conversation, and I have verbatim transcripts, and those chapters are great. So you go back and tell your good friend Nixon as he starts his presidency there's nothing more important than a taping system. And thereby, Lyndon Johnson contributes to the downfall of his good friend, Richard Nixon.
Well, there you go. So now, all these years later, has the historical view of Lyndon Johnson changed? So much of what he accomplished was overshadowed by the Vietnam legacy. Has that begun to change with time?
I think it has. I mean, you could see even when there was the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, which they celebrated a year and a half ago, and four presidents other than George Bush Sr., who wasn't well enough to go, went and celebrated LBJ's domestic legacy, that it takes time sometimes, I think, for, you know, historians and people to get away from whatever happened at the moment of the president's leaving. And when Truman left office, you know, he left under such a cloud, a low public opinion rating, lots of problems around the White House. And he's now risen in the historian's mind and the public's mind, I think, to be one of the near great presidents. And for LBJ, Vietnam was such a turmoil and such a sad experience that it made everybody forget everything else that had happened. But I think now the combination of the 50th anniversary of all these great acts, those telephone conversations which show how incredibly interesting this man was, and perhaps the political culture in Washington needing somebody like Johnson who could get both sides of the aisle to get together. He would have just locked up those congressmen and senators and kept them in the White House until those bills or deficit things got passed. It makes you appreciate even more that larger-than-life character he was. And I think that's going to keep continuing as historians look at him, you know, from this vantage point back.
I understand you're working on a new book on leadership. Is it tougher in a time... in the time of the Citizens United ruling, for there to be real leadership when people are more than ever beholden to large contributors?
I think it's a huge problem. I really do. I mean, I've often said if I were a young person again, I would be hopefully leading a charge for the constitutional amendment to undo Citizens United. It's not only that the people in power are beholden to those special interests because of the money, it's that they spend so much of their time thinking about fundraising instead of thinking about getting together and trying to get something done. You know, in the old days, even in Lyndon Johnson's days, Republicans and Democrats would stay in Washington on the weekends. They didn't run home to raise funds. They formed friendships across party lines. Their wives and children knew each other. So there was a sense of respect, even if they disagreed on issues. And now it's like tribal enemies on either side. And that narrow group that both sides are responding to, and the amount of money is just, it's disgusting when you think about that amount of money and time that's being spent just to put their names and their faces on television or in the radio.
Before we let you go, Doris, you're a big baseball fan and especially a Red Sox fan. It's been a tough season and a tumultuous couple of weeks for the Red Sox. Can you give us any optimism for the future in next year's team?
Well, I keep looking for everything I can, and you see some of those young people that have performed well, and every time they win, I keep thinking maybe this is going to start a streak. I'm afraid it's a little late for that streak to make a difference, but somebody wrote me the other day, I think they'd have to win, you know, 30 straight or something in order to get in the playoffs. But, I mean, hopefully with a new GM, I mean, I liked Charrington very much, but something had to change, I think, at this point in time. And hopefully that'll bring some new momentum and new energy in. But they made a lot of bad decisions. I mean, it doesn't seem like they put a team together that had the pitching and the batting that could work together. When one worked, the other didn't, mm-hmm. And then it was just such a sad season. But I'm glad that it's almost time for spring training next year, and then we can hope all over again.
We also have to say hello to you from our mutual friend, Steve Buckley, who was on with us the other day and said that you were a big supporter and a big help to him in his old-time baseball game.
Oh, without a question. In one of his charity events, I got to throw out the first ball.
That's what he told us.
He's a wonderful guy, absolutely wonderful guy.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, the author of Lyndon Johnson, The American Dream, now available as an e-book. It's been wonderful to go back and reread it for the first time since it came out, and always wonderful to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us, Doris.
You're very welcome. I finally feel modern that I've got an e-book from a book that was printed so many years ago, so it feels good.
It's a crazy new world we're living in.
It's a crazy new world. Thanks again. It's so good to be with you. We'll do it again.
We absolutely. Thank you, Doris. Doris Kearns Goodwin on Downtown. It's 20.